A tall mirror hung upon the wall above the sofa where the lady sat. It showed a second great white moon in a second tall dark window and a second dim mirror room. But Drawlight and the lady did not appear in the mirror room at all. Instead, there was a kind of indistinctness, which became a sort of shadow, which became the dark shape of someone coming towards them. From the path which this person took, it could clearly be seen that the mirror room was not like the original at all, and that it was only by odd tricks of lighting and perspective, such as one might meet with in the theatre, that they appeared to be the same. It seemed that the mirror room was actually a long corridor. The hair and coat of the mysterious figure was stirred by a wind which could not be felt in their own room, and though he walked briskly towards the glass which separated the two rooms, it was taking him some time to reach it. But finally, he reached the glass, and then there was a moment when his dark shape loomed very large behind it, and his face was still in shadow. Then Strange hopped down from the mirror very neatly, smiled his most charming smile, and bid both Drawlight and the lady, "Good evening." He waited a moment, as if allowing someone else time to speak, and then, when no one did, he said, "I hope you will be so kind, madam, as to forgive the lateness of my visit. To say the truth, the way was a little more meandering than I had anticipated. I took a wrong turning and very nearly arrived in, well, I do not quite know where." He paused again, as if waiting for someone to invite him to sit down. When no one did, he sat down anyway. Drawlight and the lady in the red gown stared at him. He smiled back at them. "I've been getting acquainted with Mr. Tantony," he told Drawlight. "A most pleasant gentleman, though not very talkative. His friend Mr. Gatnam, however, told me all I wished to know."
"You are Mr. Strange?" asked the lady in the red gown.
"I am, madam."
"Well, this is most fortunate. Mr. Drawlight was just explaining to me why you and I could never meet."
"It is true, madam, that until tonight circumstances did not favour our meeting. And Mr. Drawlight, pray make the introductions." Drawlight muttered that the lady in the red gown was Mrs. Bulworth. Strange rose, bowed to Mrs. Bulworth, and sat down again.
"Mr. Drawlight has, I believe, told you of my horrible situation," said Mrs. Bulworth.
Strange made a small gesture with his head, which might have meant one thing, or might have meant another thing, or might have meant nothing at all. He said, "A narration by an unconnected person can never match the tale told by someone intimately concerned with the events. There may be vital points which Mr. Drawlight has, for one reason or another, omitted. Indulge me, madam. Let me hear it from you."
"All?"
"All."
"Very well. I am, as you know, the daughter of a gentleman in Northamptonshire. My father's property is extensive. His house and income are large. We are among the first people in that county. But my family have always encouraged me to believe that with my beauty and accomplishments, I might occupy an even higher position in the world. 2 years ago, I made a very advantageous marriage. Mr. Bulworth is rich, and we moved in the most fashionable circles. But still, I was not happy. In the summer of last year, I had the misfortune to meet a man who is everything Mr. Bulworth is not. Handsome, clever, amusing. A few short weeks were enough to convince me that I preferred this man to anyone I had ever seen." She gave a little shrug of her shoulders. 2 days before Christmas, I left my husband's house in his company. I hoped, indeed expected, to divorce Mr. Bulworth and marry him. But that was not his intention. By the end of January, we had quarrelled, and my friend had deserted me. He returned to his house and all his usual pursuits. But there was to be no such revival of a former life for me. My husband cast me off. My friends refused to receive me. I was forced back upon the mercy of my father. He told me that he would provide for me for the rest of my life, but in return, I must live in perfect retirement. No more balls for me, no more parties, no more friends, no more anything."
She gazed into the distance for a moment, as if in contemplation of all that she had lost. But just as quickly, she shook off her melancholy and declared,
"And now to business."
She went to a little writing table, opened a drawer, and drew out a paper which she offered to Strange.
"I have, as you suggested, made a list of all the people who have betrayed me, she said.
Ah, I told you to make a list, did I? Said Strange, taking the paper. How businesslike I am. It is quite a long list.
Oh, said Mrs. Bulworth, every name will be considered a separate commission, and you shall have your fee for each. I have taken the liberty of writing by each name the punishment which I believe ought to be theirs, but your superior knowledge of magic may suggest other more appropriate fates for my enemies. I should be glad of your recommendations.
Sir James Southall. Gout, read Strange.
My father, explained Mrs. Bulworth. He wearied me to death with speeches upon my wicked character, and exiled me forever from my home. In many ways, it is he who is the author of all my miseries. I wish I could harden my heart enough to decree some more serious illness for him, but I cannot. I suppose that is what is meant by the weakness of women.
Gout is exceedingly painful, observed Strange. Or so I am told. Mrs. Bulworth made a gesture of impatience. Miss Elizabeth Church, continued Strange, to have her engagement broken off. Who is Miss Elizabeth Church?
A cousin of mine, a tedious embroidering sort of girl. No one ever paid her the least attention until I married Mr. Bulworth. Yet now I hear she is to be married to a clergyman, and my father has given her a banker's draft to pay for wedding clothes and new furniture. My father has promised Lizzie and the clergyman that he will use his interest to get them all sorts of preferments. Their way is to be made easy. They are to live in York, where they will attend dinners and parties and balls, and enjoy all those pleasures which ought to have been mine. Mr. Strange, she cried, growing more energetic, surely there must be spells to make the clergyman hate the very sight of Lizzie, to make him shudder at the sound of her voice.
I do not know, said Strange. I never considered the matter before. I suppose there must be. He returned to the list. Mr. Bulworth.
My husband, she said.
To be bitten by dogs.
He has 7 great black brutes, and thinks more of them than of any human creature.
Mrs. Bulworth Senior, your husband's mother, I suppose. To be drowned in a laundry tub. To be choked to death on her own apricot preserves. To be baked accidentally in a bread oven. That is 3 deaths for 1 woman. Forgive me, Mrs. Bulworth, but the greatest magician that ever lived could not kill the same person 3 different ways.
Do as much as you can manage, said Mrs. Bulworth stubbornly. The old woman is so insufferably proud of her housekeeping. She bored me to death upon the subject.
I see. Well, this is all very Shakespearean. And so we come to the last name. Henry Lascelles. I know this gentleman. Strange looked inquiringly at Drawlight.
Mrs. Bulworth said, That is the person under whose protection I left my husband's house.
Ah. And what shall his fate be?
Bankruptcy, she said in a fierce, low voice. Lunacy, fire, a disfiguring disease, a horse to trample upon him, a villain to lie in wait for him and cut his face with a knife, a vision of horror to haunt him and drive away sleep night after night.
She rose and began to pace about the room.
Let every mean and dishonorable action he ever did be published in the newspaper. Let everyone in London shun him. Let him seduce some country girl who will go mad for love of him. Let her follow him wherever he goes for years and years. Let him become an object of ridicule because of her. Let her never leave him in peace. Let some mistake upon the part of an honest man lead to his being accused of a crime. Let him suffer all the indignities of trial and imprisonment. Let him be branded, let him be beaten, let him be whipped, and let him be executed.
Mrs. Bulworth, said Strange, pray calm yourself. Mrs. Bulworth stopped pacing. She ceased calling down horrible fates upon Mr. Lascelles' head, but still she could hardly have been said to be calm. Her breath came rapidly, and she trembled all over, and her face still worked furiously. Strange watched until he judged her enough in command of herself to understand what he wanted to say, and then he began. I'm sorry, Mrs. Bulworth, but you have been the victim of a cruel deception. This, he glanced at Drawlight, person, has lied to you. Mr. Norrow and I have never undertaken commissions for private individuals. We have never employed this person as an agent to find business for us. I never even heard your name until tonight. Mrs. Bulworth stared at him a moment, and then turning upon Drawlight,
Is this true?
Drawlight fixed his miserable gaze upon the carpet and mumbled some sort of speech in which only the words "madam" and "peculiar situation" were discernible. Mrs. Bulworth reached up and rang the bell pull. The maid who had let Drawlight into the house reappeared.
"Haverhill," said Mrs. Bulworth, "remove Mr. Drawlight."
Unlike the majority of maids in fashionable households who are chosen mainly for their pretty faces, Haverhill was a competent-looking person of the middle age, with strong arms and an unforgiving expression. But on this occasion, she was required to do very little, since Mr. Drawlight was only too grateful for the opportunity to remove himself. He picked up his stick and scuttled out of the room the moment Haverhill opened the door. Mrs. Bulworth turned to Strange.
"Will you help me? Will you do what I ask? If the money is not sufficient..."
"Oh, the money." Strange made a dismissive gesture. "I'm sorry, but as I have just told you, I do not undertake private commissions." She stared at him, and then said in a wondering tone,
"Can it be that you are entirely unmoved by the misery of my situation?"
"Upon the contrary, Mrs. Bulworth, a system of morality which punishes the woman and leaves no share of blame to the man seems to me quite detestable. But beyond that I will not go. I will not hurt innocent people."
"Innocent?" she cried. "Innocent? Who is innocent? No one."
"Mrs. Bulworth, there is nothing to be said. I can do nothing for you. I'm sorry." She regarded him sourly.
Well, at least you have the grace to refrain from recommending repentance or good works or needlework or whatever it is that other fools hold up as a cure for a blank life and a broken heart. Nevertheless, I think it will be best for both of us if this interview is brought to a conclusion. Good night, Mr. Strange."
Strange bowed. As he left the room, he gave a wistful glance at the mirror above the sofa, as if he would have preferred to depart by that means. But Haverhill held the door open, and common politeness obliged him to go through it. Having neither horse nor carriage, he walked the 5 miles from Hampstead to Soho Square. On arriving at his own front door, he discovered that although it was almost 2 o'clock in the morning, there was a light in every window of the house. Before he could even fish in his pocket for his door key, the door was flung open by Colhern Grant.
"Good heavens, what are you doing here?" cried Strange.
Grant did not trouble to answer him, but instead turned back into the house and called,
"He's here, ma'am! He's quite safe!"
Arabella came running, almost tumbling, out of the drawing-room, followed a moment later by Sir Walter. Then Jeremy Johns and several of the servants appeared in the passageway leading to the kitchen.
"Has something happened? Is something wrong?" asked Strange, gazing at them all in surprise.
"Blockhead!" laughed Grant, striking him affectionately on the head. "We were concerned about you. Where in the world have you been?"
"Hampstead."
"Hampstead?" exclaimed Sir Walter. "Well, we're very glad to see you."
He glanced at Arabella and added nervously,
"I fear we have made Mrs. Strange anxious for no good reason."
"Oh," said Strange to his wife, "you were not afraid, were you?"
"I was perfectly well. I always am."
"There, ma'am," declared Colonel Grant cheerfully, "is just as I told you. In Spain, Mr. Strange was often in great peril, but we were never in the least concerned about him. He is too clever to come to any harm."
"Must we stand in the hallway?" asked Strange. On the way from Hampstead, he'd been thinking about magic, and he'd intended to continue doing so at home. Instead, he found a house full of people all talking together. It put him out of humor. He led the way into the drawing-room and asked Jeremy to bring him some wine and something to eat. When they were all seated, he said, "It was just as we supposed. Drawlight has been arranging for Norrell and I to perform every sort of black magic you can think of. I found him with a most excitable young woman who wanted me to inflict torments upon her relations."
"How horrible," said Colonel Grant. "And what did Drawlight say?" asked Sir Walter. "How did he explain himself?"
"Ha!" Strange let out a short burst of uncheerful laughter.
"He did not say anything. He simply ran away, which is a pity, as I had a great mind to challenge him to a duel."
"Oh," said Arabella suddenly, "it is duels now, is it?"
Sir Walter and Grant both looked at her in alarm. But Strange was too absorbed in what he was saying to notice her angry expression.
"Not that I suppose he would have accepted, but I should have liked to frighten him a little. God knows he deserves it." "But you've not said anything about this kingdom, path, whatever it is, behind the mirror," said Colonel Grant. Did it answer your expectations?
Strange shook his head. I do not have the words to describe it. All that Norrell and I have done is as nothing in comparison, and yet we have the audacity to call ourselves magicians. I wish I could give you the idea of its grandeur, of its size and complexity, of the great stone halls that lead off in every direction. I tried at first to judge their length and number, but soon gave up. There seemed no end to them. There were canals of still water in stone embankments. The water appeared black in the gloomy light. I saw staircases that rose up so high I could not see the top of them, and others that descended into utter blackness. And then suddenly I passed under an arch and found myself upon a stone bridge that crossed a dark, empty landscape. The bridge was so vast that I could not see the end of it. Imagine a bridge that joined Islington to Twickenham, or York to Newcastle, and everywhere in the halls and on the bridge I saw his likeness.
Whose likeness? Asked Sir Walter.
The man that Norrell and I have slandered in almost everything we have written. The man whose name Norrell can hardly bear to hear mentioned. The man who built the halls, canals, bridge, everything. John Usklas, the Raven King. Of course, the structure has fallen into disrepair over the centuries. Whatever John Usklas once used these roads for, it seems he no longer needs them. Statues and masonry have collapsed. Shafts of light break in from God knows where. Some halls are blocked while others are flooded. And I will tell you something else very curious. There were a great number of discarded shoes everywhere I went. Presumably, they belonged to other travelers. They were of a very ancient style and much decayed, from which I conclude that these passages have been little frequented in recent years. In all the time I was walking, I only saw one other person.
You saw someone else? Said Sir Walter.
Oh, yes. At least, I think it was a person. I saw a shadow moving along a white road that crossed the dark moor. You must understand that I was upon the bridge at the time, and it was much higher than any bridge I have ever seen in this world. The ground appeared to be several thousand feet beneath me. I looked down and saw someone. If I had not been so set upon finding Drawlight, I would certainly have found a way down and followed him or her, for it seems to me that there could be no better way for a magician to spend his time than in conversation with such a person. But would such a person be safe? Asked Arabella.
Safe? Said Strange, contemptuously.
Oh, no, I do not think so. But then I flatter myself that neither am I particularly safe. I hope I have not missed my chance. I hope that when I return tomorrow, I will find some clue as to where the mysterious figure went.
Return? Exclaimed Sir Walter. But are you sure?
Oh, cried Arabella, interrupting. I see how it is to be. You will be walking these paths every moment Mr. Norrell can spare you, while I remain here in condition of the most miserable suspense, wondering if I'm ever to see you again.
Strange looked at her in surprise.
Arabella, whatever is the matter? The matter? You are set upon putting yourself in the most horrible danger, and you expect me to say nothing about it?
Strange made a sort of gesture of combined appeal and helplessness, as if he were calling upon Sir Walter and Grant to bear witness how exceedingly unreasonable this was. He said,
But when I told you I was going to Spain, you were perfectly composed, even though a vicious war was raging there at the time.
This, on the other hand, is quite perfectly composed. I assure you I was nothing of the kind. I was horribly afraid for you, as were all the wives and mothers and sisters of the men in Spain. But you and I agreed that you had a duty to go. And besides, in Spain you had the entire British army with you, whereas there you will be perfectly alone. I say there, but none of us knows where there is.
I beg your pardon, but I know exactly where it is. It is the King's Roads. Really, Arabella, I think it is a little late in the day to decide you do not like my profession.
Oh, that is not fair. I have never said a word against your profession. I think it one of the noblest in the world. I am proud beyond measure of what you and Mr. Norrell have done, and I have never objected in the least to your learning whatever new magic you saw fit. But until today you have always been content to make your discoveries in books.
Well, no longer. To confine a magician's researches to the books in his library, well, you might just as well tell an explorer that you approve his plan to search for the source of whatever it is those African rivers are called, on the condition that he never steps outside Tunbridge Wells. Arabella gave an exclamation of exasperation.
I thought you meant to be a magician, not an explorer.
It's the same thing. An explorer cannot stay at home reading maps other men have made. A magician cannot increase the stock of magic by reading other men's books. It is quite obvious to me that sooner or later Norrell and I must look beyond our books.
Indeed, that is obvious to you, is it? Well, Jonathan, I very much doubt that it's obvious to Mr. Norrell.
Throughout this exchange, Sir Walter and Lieutenant Colonel Grant looked as uncomfortable as any two people can who inadvertently find themselves witnesses to a little outburst of marital disharmony. Nor was their situation improved by the consciousness that, just at present, neither Arabella nor Strange was feeling particularly well disposed towards them. They had already had to endure some sharp words from Arabella when they had confessed their part in encouraging Strange to perform the dangerous magic. Now Strange was directing angry glances at them, as if he wondered by what right they had come to his house in the middle of the night and put his usually sweet-tempered wife out of temper. As soon as there was anything like a pause in the conversation, Colonel Grant muttered something incoherent about the lateness of the hour and about their kind hospitality being more than he deserved and about wishing them all good night. But then, as no one paid the slightest attention to his speech, he was obliged to continue where he was. Sir Walter, however, was of a more resolute character. He concluded that he'd been wrong in sending Strange upon the mirror path, and he was determined to do what he could to put matters right. Being a politician, he was never dissuaded from giving anybody his opinion by the mere fact that they were not inclined to hear it.
"Have you read every book upon magic?"
he demanded of Strange.
"What?
No, of course not. You know very well I have not," said Strange. He was thinking of the books in the library at Hurtview.
"These halls that you saw tonight, do you know where they all lead?"
asked Sir Walter.
"No,"
said Strange.
"Do you know what the dark land is that the bridge crosses?"
"No, but, oh, then surely it would be better to do as Mrs. Strange suggests and read all you can about these roads before returning to them,"
said Sir Walter. "But the information in books is inaccurate and contradictory. Even Norrell says so, and he has read everything there is to read about them. You may be certain of that." Arabella, Strange, and Sir Walter continued to argue for another half hour, until everyone was cross and wretched and longing to go to bed. Only Strange seemed at all comfortable with these descriptions of eerie, silent halls, unending pathways and vast dark landscapes. Arabella was genuinely frightened by what she heard, and even Sir Walter and Colonel Grant felt decidedly unsettled. Magic, which had seemed so familiar just hours before, so English, had suddenly become inhuman, unearthly, otherlandish. As for Strange, it was his decided opinion that they were the most incomprehensible and infuriating set of people in the country. They did not appear to comprehend that he had done something entirely remarkable. It would not be going too far, he thought, to say that this had been the most extraordinary achievement of his career so far. No English magician since Martin Pale had been on the King's Roads. But instead of congratulating him and praising his skill, which anyone else would have done, all they did was complain in a Norrellish sort of way. The following morning he awoke determined to return to the King's Roads. He greeted Arabella cheerfully, talked to her upon indifferent subjects, and generally tried to pretend that the quarrel had been due to her tiredness and overwrought state the previous evening. But long before he could take advantage of this convenient fiction and slip away to the roads by the nearest large mirror, Arabella told him very plainly that she felt just the same as she had last night. In the end, is it not futile to try and follow the course of a quarrel between husband and wife? Such a conversation is sure to meander more than any other. It draws in tributary arguments and grievances from years before, all quite incomprehensible to any but the two people they concern most nearly. Neither party has ever proved right or wrong in such a case, or if they are, what does it signify? The desire to live in harmony and friendship with one's spouse is very strong, and Strange and Arabella were no different from other people in this respect. Finally, after 2 days arguing the point back and forth, they made each other a promise. He promised her not to go upon the King's Roads again until she said that he might. In return, she promised him to grant him that permission just as soon as he convinced her that it was safe to do so. Chapter 37. The Cinque Dragons. November 1814. 7 years ago, Mr. Lascelles' house in Bruton Street was generally reckoned to be one of the best in London. It had the sort of perfection that can only be achieved by a very rich, very idle man who devotes the greater part of his time to collecting pictures and sculpture, and the greater part of his mental energies to choosing furniture and wallpapers. His taste was remarkably good, and he had a talent for combining colours in new and quite striking ways. He was particularly fond of blues, greys, and a sort of darkish metallic bronze. Yet he never became sentimentally attached to his possessions. He sold paintings as frequently as he bought them, and his house never deteriorated into that picture gallery confusion which besets the homes of some collectors. Each of Lascelles' rooms contained only a handful of pictures and objets d'art, but that handful included some of the most beautiful and remarkable objects in all of London. In the last 7 years, however, the perfection of Mr. Lascelles' house had become somewhat diminished. The colours were as exquisite as ever, but they had not been changed for 7 years. The furnishings were expensive, but they represented what had been most fashionable 7 years ago. In the last 7 years, no new paintings had been added to Lascelles' collection. In the last 7 years, remarkable antique sculptures had arrived in London from Italy, Egypt, and Greece, but other gentlemen had bought them. What is more, there were signs that the owner of the house had been engaged in useful occupation, that he had, in short, been working. Reports, manuscripts, letters, and government papers lay upon every table and chair, and copies of the Friends of English Magic and books on magic were to be found in every room. The truth was that though Lascelles still affected to despise work, in the 7 years since Mr. Norrell had first arrived in London, he had been busier than ever before. Though it had been his suggestion to appoint Lord Portishead editor of the Friends of English Magic, the manner in which his lordship had carried on his editorial duties had exasperated Lascelles to a degree scarcely to be borne. Lord Portishead had deferred to Mr. Norrell in all things, had instantly executed all of Mr. Norrell's unnecessary amendments, and as a result, the Friends of English Magic had grown duller and more circumlocutious with every issue. In the autumn of 1810, Lascelles had contrived to have himself appointed joint editor. The Friends of English Magic had one of the largest subscriptions of any periodical in the kingdom. The work was not inconsiderable. In addition, Lascelles wrote upon modern magic for other periodicals and newspapers. He advised the government upon magical policy. He visited Mr. Norrell almost every day, and in his spare time, he studied the history and theory of magic. On the third day after Strange had paid his visit to Mrs. Bulworth, Lascelles happened to be working hard in his library upon the next issue of the Friends of English Magic. Though it was a little after noon, he had not yet found the time to shave and dress, and was sitting in his dressing gown amid a litter of books, papers, breakfast plates, and coffee cups. A letter he wanted was missing, and so he went to look for it. On entering the drawing room, he was surprised to find someone there. "Oh," he said, "it's you." The wretched-looking creature who drooped in a chair by the fire raised his head. He said, "Your servant has gone to find you and tell you I'm here." "Ah," said Lascelles, and paused, apparently at loss for something to say next. He sat down in the opposite chair, rested his head upon his hand, and regarded Drawlight thoughtfully. Drawlight's face was pale, and his eyes were sunk in his head. His coat was dusty, his boots were but indifferently polished, and even his linen had a wilted look. "I think it is most unkind of you," said Lascelles at last, "to accept money for arranging to have me ruined, crippled, and driven mad. And from Maria Bulworth, of all people. Why she should be so angry is quite beyond me. It was quite as much her doing as mine. I did not force her to marry Bulworth. I merely offered her an escape when she could no longer bear the sight of him. Is it true that she wanted Strange to inflict leprosy upon me?"
"Oh, probably," sighed Drawlight. "I really do not know. There was never the least danger in the world that anything would happen to you. You sit there every bit as rich, healthy, and comfortable as ever you were, whereas I am the wretchedest being in London. I have not slept in 3 days. This morning my hands were shaking so much I could scarcely tie my cravat. No one knows what mortification it is to me to appear in this scarecrow condition. Not that anyone will see me, so what does it matter? I have been turned away from every door in London. Yours is the only house where I am admitted." He paused. I ought not to have told you that.
Lascelles shrugged.
What I do not understand, he said, is how you expected to succeed with such a perfectly absurd scheme.
It was not in the least absurd. Upon the contrary, I was scrupulous in my choice of clients. Maria Bulworth lives in perfect retirement from society. Gatcombe and Tantony are brewers, from Nottinghamshire. Who could have predicted that they and Strange would ever meet?
And what of Miss Grey? Arabella Strange met her at Lady Westby's house in Bedford Square. Drawlight sighed.
Miss Grey was 18 years old and lived with her guardians in Whitby. According to the terms of her father's will, she was obliged to consult their wishes in everything she did until she was 36. They detested London and were determined never to leave Whitby. Unfortunately, they both caught colds and died very suddenly 2 months ago, and the wretched girl immediately set off for the capital.
Drawlight paused and licked his lips nervously.
Is Norrell very angry?
Beyond anything I ever saw, said Lascelles softly.
Drawlight retreated a little further into his chair.
What will they do?
I don't know. Since your little adventure became known, I thought it best to absent myself from Hanover Square for a while. I heard from Admiral Summerhayes that Strange wished to call you out.
Drawlight gave a sort of yelp of fright.
But Arabella disapproves of dueling, and so nothing came of it. Norrell has no right to be angry with me, declared Drawlight suddenly. He owes everything to me. Magicianship is all very well, but had it not been for me taking him about and showing him to people, no one would ever have heard of him. He could not do without me then, and he cannot do without me now. You think so?
Drawlight's dark eyes grew larger than ever, and he put a finger in his mouth as though to gnaw a fingernail for comfort, but finding that he was still wearing his gloves, he took it out again quickly.
I shall call again this evening, he said. Shall you be at home?
Oh, probably. I've half promised Lady Blessington to go to her salon, but I doubt that I shall go. We're horribly behind with the friends. Norrell keeps plaguing us with contradictory instructions.
So much work. My poor Lascelles, that will not suit you at all. What a slave driver the old man is.
After Drawlight had gone, Lascelles rang for his servant.
I shall go out in an hour, Emerson. Tell Wallace to get my clothes ready. Oh, and Emerson, Mr. Drawlight has expressed an intention of returning here later this evening. When he comes, do not upon any consideration admit him.
At the same time that the above conversation was taking place, Mr. Norrell, Mr. Strange, and John Childermas were gathered in the library at Hanover Square to discuss Drawlight's treachery. Mr. Norrell sat in silence, staring into the fire, while Childermas described to Strange how he had discovered another of Drawlight's dupes, an elderly gentleman in Twickenham called Palgrave, who had given Drawlight 200 guineas to have his life prolonged by another 80 years, and his youth returned to him.
I'm not sure, continued Childermas, that we will ever know for certain how many people have paid Drawlight in the belief that they were commissioning you to perform black magic. Both Mr. Tantony and Miss Grey have received promises of some future position in a hierarchy of magicians which Drawlight told them would soon exist, and which I do not pretend to understand very well.
Strange sighed. How we shall ever convince people that we had no part in it, I do not know.
We should do something, but I confess that I have not the least idea what.
Suddenly Mr. Norrell said,
I have been considering the matter very carefully during the last 2 days. Indeed, I may say that I have thought of little else. And I have come to the conclusion that we must revive the Cinq Dragons.
Footnote 1. Les Cinq Dragons, the Five Dragons. This court took its name not, as is generally supposed, from the ferocity of its judges, but from a chamber in the house of John Usglas, the Raven King, in Newcastle, where the judgments were originally given. This chamber was said to be 12-sided and to be decorated by wonderful carvings, some of them the work of men and some of them the work of fairies. The most marvellous of all were the carvings of 5 dragons. Crimes tried by the Cinq Dragons included evil tendings, magic with an inherently malevolent purpose, a false magic, pretending to do magic or promising to do magic, which one either could not or did not intend to do, selling magic rings, hats, shoes, coats, belts, shovels, beans, musical instruments, etc., etc., to people who could not be expected to control those powerful articles, pretending to be a magician or pretending to act on behalf of a magician, teaching magic to unsuitable persons, for example, drunkards, madmen, children, persons of vicious habits and inclinations, and many other magical crimes committed by trained magicians and other Christians. Crimes against the person of John Usklas were also tried by the Sankt Dragones. The only category of magical crimes with which the Sankt Dragones had nothing to do was crimes by fairies. These were dealt with by the separate court of Folfleurs. In England, in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, a thriving community of magicians and fairies was continually performing magic. Magic is notoriously difficult to regulate, and naturally enough, not all the magic that was done was well-intentioned. John Usklas seems to have devoted a great deal of time and energy to the creation of a body of law to govern magic and magicians. When the practice of magic spread throughout England, the southern English kings were only too grateful to borrow the wisdom of their northern neighbour. It is a peculiarity of that time that though England was divided into two countries with separate judiciary systems, the body of law which governed magic was the same for both. The southern English equivalent of the Sankt Dragones was called the Petty Dragones of London and was situated near Blackfriars. There was a short silence, and then Strange said, "I beg your pardon, sir. Did you say the Sankt Dragones?" Mr. Norrell nodded.
"It is quite clear to me that this villain should be tried by the Sankt Dragones. He is guilty of false magic and evil tendings. Happily, the old medieval law has never been revoked."
"Old medieval law," said Childermas with a short laugh, "required 12 magicians to sit in judgment in the court of Sankt Dragones. There are not 12 magicians in England. You know very well there are not. There are 2.
"We could find others," said Mr. Norrell.
Strange and Childermas looked at him in astonishment. Mr. Norrell had the grace to appear a little embarrassed, contradicting all that he had maintained for 7 years, but nevertheless he continued.
"There is Lord Portishead, and that dark little man in York who would not sign the agreement. That is 2, and I dare say," here he looked at Childermas, "you will find some more if you put your mind to it."
Childermas opened his mouth, presumably to say something of all the magicians he had already found for Mr. Norrell. Magicians who were magicians no longer now that Mr. Norrell had their books, or had turned them out of their businesses, or made them sign pernicious agreements, or in some other way destroyed them. "Forgive me, Mr. Norrell," interrupted Strange, "but when I spoke of something being done, I meant an advertisement in the newspaper or something of that sort. I very much doubt that Lord Liverpool and the ministers would allow us, for the sake of punishing one man, to revive a branch of English law that has been defunct for more than 200 years. And even if they were so obliging as to permit it, I think we must assume that 12 magicians means 12 practicing magicians. Lord Portishead and John Segundus are both theoretical magicians. Besides, it's very likely that Drawlight will soon be prosecuted for fraud, forgery, theft, and I do not know what else. I fail to see what advantage the Sankt Dragones has over common law courts."
"The justice of the common law courts is entirely unpredictable. The judge will know nothing of magic. The magnitude of this man's crimes will be entirely lost upon him. I am speaking of his crimes against English magic, his crimes against me. The Sankt Dragones was renowned for its severity. I consider it our best security that he will be hanged."
"Hanged?
Oh, yes. I am quite determined to see him hanged. I thought that was what we were talking about."
Mr. Norrell blinked his small eyes rapidly.
"Mr. Norrell," said Strange, "I'm quite as angry with this man as you are. He is unprincipled, he's deceitful, he's everything I despise. But I will not be the cause of anyone's death. I was in the peninsula, sir. I've seen enough men die."
"But 2 days ago you wished to challenge him to a duel."
Strange gave him an angry look. "That is quite another thing."
"In any case," continued Mr. Norrell, "I scarcely think Drawlight more to blame than you."
"Me?" cried Strange, startled. "Why, what have I done?"
"Oh, you know very well what I mean. What in the world possessed you to go upon the King's roads, alone and entirely without preparation? You could hardly suppose that I would approve such a wild adventure. Your actions that night will do as much to bring magic into disrepute as anything that man has done. Indeed, they will probably do more. No one ever did think well of Christopher Drawlight. It's no surprise to anyone that he turns out a villain. But you are known everywhere as my pupil. You are the second magician in the land. People would think that I approved what you did. People would think that this is part of my plan for the restoration of English magic.
Strange stared at his master. God forbid, Mr. Norrell, that you should feel compromised by any action of mine. Nothing, I assure you, could be further from my wishes. But it is easily remedied. If you and I part company, sir, then each of us may act independently. The world will judge each of us without reference to the other. Mr. Norrell looked very shocked. He glanced at Strange, glanced away again, and muttered in a low voice that he had not meant that. He hoped Mr. Strange knew that he had not meant that. He cleared his throat.
I hope Mr. Strange will make some allowance for the irritation of my spirits. I hope Mr. Strange cares enough for English magic to bear with my fretfulness. He knows how important it is that he and I speak and act together for the good of English magic. It is altogether too soon for English magic to be exposed to the buffeting of contrary winds. If Mr. Strange and I begin to contradict each other upon important matters of magical policy, then I do not believe that English magic will survive.
A silence. Strange rose from his chair and made Mr. Norrell a stiff, formal bow. The next few moments were awkward. Mr. Norrell looked as if he would have been glad to say something, but was at a loss for a subject.
It so happened that Lord Portishead's new book, The Essay on the Extraordinary Revival of English Magic, had just arrived from the printer and was lying to hand upon a little table. Mr. Norrell seized upon it.
What an excellent little work this is, and how devoted to our cause is Lord Portishead. After such a crisis, one does not feel much inclined to trust anybody, and yet I think we may always rely upon Lord Portishead.
He handed Strange the book. Strange turned the pages thoughtfully. He has certainly done everything we asked. Two long chapters attacking the Raven King, and scarcely a mention of fairies at all. As I remember, his original manuscript had a long description of the Raven King's magic.
Yes, indeed, said Mr. Norrell. Until you made those corrections, it was worthless. Worse than worthless. Dangerous. But the long hours you spent with him guiding his opinions have all borne fruit. I'm excessively pleased with it.
By the time Lucas brought in the tray with the tea things, the two magicians seemed like their natural selves again, though Strange was perhaps a little quieter than usual. The quarrel seemed mended. Just before Strange left, he asked if he might borrow Lord Portishead's book.
Certainly, cried Mr. Norrell. Keep it as your own. I have several other copies.
Despite all that Strange and Childermas had said against it, Mr. Norrell was unable to give up his plan to revive the Sanct Dragones. The more he thought of it, the more it seemed to him that he would never enjoy peace again until there was a proper court of magical law in England. He felt that no punishment that might be meted out to Drawlight from any other quarter could ever satisfy him. So later that day, he sent Childermas to Lord Liverpool's house to beg the favor of a few minutes' conversation with his lordship. Lord Liverpool sent back a message that he would see Mr. Norrell upon the following day. At the appointed hour, Mr. Norrell waited upon the Prime Minister and explained his plan. When he had finished, Lord Liverpool frowned.
But magical law has fallen into disuse in England, said his lordship. There are no lawyers trained to practice in such a court. Who would take the cases? Who would judge them?
Ah, exclaimed Mr. Norrell, producing a thick sheaf of papers. I'm glad your lordship asks such pertinent questions. I have drawn up a document describing the workings of the Sanct Dragones. Sadly, there are many lacunae in our knowledge, but I have suggested ways in which we might restore what has been lost. I have taken as my model the ecclesiastical courts of the Doctors' Commons. As your lordship will see, we have a great deal of work before us.
Lord Liverpool glanced at the papers.
Too much work by far, Mr. Norrell, he declared flatly.
Oh, but it's very necessary, I assure you. Very necessary indeed. How else will we regulate magic? How else will we guard against wicked magicians and their servants?
What wicked magicians? There is only Mr. Strange and you.
Well, that is true, but do you feel particularly wicked at present, Mr. Norrell?
Is there some pressing reason that the British government should establish a separate body of law to control your vicious tendencies?
No, I...
Or perhaps Mr. Strange is exhibiting a strong inclination to murder, maim, and steal.
No, but
Then all we are left with is this Mr. Drawlight, who, as far as I can tell, is not a magician at all.
But his crimes are specifically magical crimes. Under English law, he ought to be tried by the Court of St. Dragones. It is the proper place for him. These are the names of his crimes.
Mr. Norrell placed yet another list before the Prime Minister.
There. False magic, evil tendings, and malevolent pedagogy. No ordinary court is competent to deal with them.
No doubt. But as I have already observed, there is no one who can try the case.
If your lordship will only cast your eye over page 42 of my notes, I propose employing judges, advocates, and proctors from the Doctor's Commons. I could explain the principles of thaumaturgic law to them. It would take no more than a week or so. And I could lend them my servant, John Childermas, for as long as the trial lasts. He's a very knowledgeable man, and could easily tell them when they were going wrong.
What? The judge and lawyers to be coached in their duties by the plaintiff and his servant? Certainly not. Justice recoils from the idea. Mr. Norrell blinked.
But what other security do I have that other magicians might not arise to challenge my authority and contradict me?
Mr. Norrell, it is not the duty of the court, any court, to exalt one person's opinions above others. Not in magic, nor in any other sphere of life. If other magicians think differently from you, then you must battle it out with them. You must prove the superiority of your opinions, as I do in politics. You must argue and publish and practice your magic, and you must learn to live as I do, in the face of constant criticism, opposition, and censure. That, sir, is the English way.
But I'm sorry, Mr. Norrell.
I will hear no more. That is an end of it. The government of Great Britain is grateful to you. You have done your country immeasurable service. Anyone may know how highly we prize you, but what you ask is quite impossible. Drawlight's deception soon became common knowledge, and as Strange had predicted, a certain amount of blame attached to the two magicians. Drawlight was, after all, the bosom companion of one of them. It made an excellent subject for the caricaturists, and several quite startling examples were published. One by George Cruikshank showed Mr. Norrell making a long speech to a group of his admirers about the nobility of English magic, while in a back room, Strange dictated a sort of bill of fare to a servant who chalked it up upon a blackboard. For killing a slight acquaintance by magic, 20 guineas. For killing a close friend, 40 guineas. For killing a relation, 100 guineas. For killing a spouse, 400 guineas. In another caricature by Rowlandson, a fashionable lady was walking in the street, leading a fluffy little dog upon a leash. She was met by some of her acquaintance, who began exclaiming over her dog,
"La, Mrs. Fuchs, what a sweet little pug!"
"Yes," replied Mrs. Fuchs, "it is Mr. Fuchs. I paid Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell 50 guineas to make my husband obedient to my every desire, and this is the result." There is no doubt that the caricatures and malicious paragraphs in the newspapers did the cause of English magic considerable damage. It was now possible for magic to be considered in quite a different light, not as the nation's greatest defense, but as the tool of malice and envy. And what of the people whom Drawlight had harmed? How did they view matters? There is no doubt that Mr. Palgrave, the ancient, sick, and disagreeable person who had hoped to live forever, intended to prosecute Drawlight for fraud, but he was prevented from doing so by the circumstance of his dying suddenly the next day. His children and heirs, who all hated him, were rather pleased than otherwise to discover that his last days had been characterized by frustration, misery, and disappointment. Nor did Drawlight have anything to fear from Miss Grey or Mrs. Bulworth. Miss Grey's friends and relations would not allow her to become embroiled in a vulgar court case, and Mrs. Bulworth's instructions to Drawlight had been so malicious as to make her culpable herself. She was powerless to strike at him. That left Gatcombe and Tantony, the Nottinghamshire brewers. As a practical man of business, Mr. Gatcombe was chiefly concerned to recover the money and sent bailiffs to London to fetch it. Unfortunately, Drawlight was unable to oblige Mr. Gatcombe in this small particular, as he had spent it all long ago. And so we come to Drawlight's real downfall, for no sooner had he escaped the gallows than his true nemesis appeared in the already cloudy sky of his existence, whirling through the air upon black wings to crush him. He had never been rich, indeed, quite the reverse. He lived chiefly upon credit and by borrowing from his friends. Sometimes he won money at gambling clubs, but more often he encouraged foolish young Toms and Jerrys to gamble, and when they lost, which they invariably did,
He would take them by the arm, and talking all the while, would lead them to this or that moneylender of his acquaintance.
I could not honestly recommend you to any other moneylender,
he would tell them solicitously.
They require such monstrous amounts of interest. But Mr. Buzzard is quite another sort. He's such a kindly old gentleman. He cannot bear to see anybody denied a pleasure when he has the means of obtaining it for them. I truly think that he considers the lending of small sums of money more in the light of a work of charity than a business venture.
For this small but important role in luring young men into debt, vice, and ruination, Drawlight received payment from the moneylenders, generally 4% of the first year's interest for the son of a commoner, 6% for the son of a viscount or baronet, and 10% for the son of an earl or duke. News of his disgrace began to circulate. Tailors, hatters, and glovemakers to whom he owed money became anxious and began to clamour for payment. Debts which he had confidently supposed might be put off for another 4 or 5 years were suddenly revived and made matters of urgency. Rough-faced men with sticks in their hands came pounding upon his door. He was advised by several people to go abroad immediately, but he could not quite believe that he was so entirely forsaken by his friends. He thought Mr. Norrell would relent. He thought Lascelles, his dear, dear Lascelles, would help him. He sent them both respectful letters requesting the immediate loan of 400 guineas. But Mr. Norrell never replied, and Lascelles only wrote to say that he made it a rule never to lend money to anyone. Drawlight was arrested for debt upon the Tuesday morning, and by the following Friday, he was a prisoner in the King's Bench prison. On an evening towards the end of November, a week or so after these events, Strange and Arabella were sitting in the drawing room at Soho Square. Arabella was writing a letter, and Strange was plucking absent-mindedly at his hair and staring straight ahead of him. Suddenly, he got up and went out of the room. He reappeared an hour later with a dozen sheets of paper covered in writing. Arabella looked up. I thought the article for the Friends of English Magic was done, she said. This is not the article for the Friends of English Magic. It is a review of Portishead's book. Arabella frowned. But you cannot review a book which you yourself helped write. I believe I might, under certain circumstances. Indeed. And what circumstances are those? If I say it is an abominable book, a wicked fraud perpetrated upon the British public. Arabella stared at him. Jonathan, she said at last. Well, it is an abominable book. He handed her the sheaf of papers, and she began to read them. The mantelpiece clock struck 9, and Jeremy brought in the tea things. When she had finished, she sighed. What are you going to do? I do not know. Publish it, I suppose. But what of poor Lord Portishead? If he has written things in his book that are wrong, then of course someone ought to say so, but you know very well that he only wrote them because you told him to. He will feel himself very ill-used. Quite. It is a wretched business from start to finish, said Strange unconcernedly. He sipped his tea and ate a piece of toast. But that is not the point. Ought I to allow my regard for Portishead to prevent me from saying what I think is true? I do not think so. Do you? But must it be you? Said Arabella with a miserable look. Poor man. He will feel it so much more coming from you. Strange frowned. Of course it must be me. Who else is there? But come. I promise you I will make him a very handsome apology just as soon as the occasion arises. And with that, Arabella was obliged to be content. In the meantime, Strange considered where he should send his review. His choice fell upon Mr. Jeffrey, the editor of the Edinburgh Review in Scotland. The Edinburgh Review, it may be remembered, was a radical publication in favour of political reform, emancipation of Catholics and Jews, and all sorts of other things Mr. Norrell did not approve. As a consequence, in recent years, Mr. Jeffrey had seen reviews and articles upon the revival of English magic appear in rival publications, while he, poor fellow, had none. Naturally, he was delighted to receive Strange's review. He was not in the least concerned about its astonishing and revolutionary content, since that was the sort of thing that he liked best. He wrote Strange a letter immediately, assuring him that he would publish it as soon as possible, and a couple of days later he sent Strange a haggis, a sort of Scotch pudding, as a present. Chapter 38
From the Edinburgh Review, January 1815. Article 13. Essay on the Extraordinary Revival of English Magic, by John Waterbury, Lord Portishead, with an account of the magic done in the late Peninsular War, by Jonathan Strange, Magician in Ordinary, to His Grace the Duke of Wellington, London 1814, John Murray. As the valued aide and confidant of Mr. Norrell and the friend of Mr. Strange, Lord Portishead is admirably fitted to write the history of recent magical events, for he has been at the centre of many of them. Each of Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange's achievements has been widely discussed in the newspapers and reviews, but Lord Portishead's readers will have their understanding much improved by having the tale set out for them in its entirety. Mr. Norrell's more enthusiastic admirers would have us believe that he arrived in London in the spring of 1807 fully formed as England's greatest magician and the first phenomenon of the age. But it is clear from Portishead's account that both he and Strange have grown in confidence and skill from very tentative beginnings. Portishead does not neglect to mention their failures as well as their successes. Chapter 5 contains a tragi-comic account of their long-running argument with the Horse Guards, which began in 1810 when one of the generals had the original notion of replacing the cavalry horses with unicorns. In this way, it was hoped to grant the soldiers the power of goring Frenchmen through their hearts. Unfortunately, this excellent plan was never implemented, since, far from finding unicorns in sufficient number for the cavalry's use, Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange have yet to discover a single one. Of more dubious value is the second half of his lordship's book, wherein he leaves description behind and begins to lay down rules to determine what is and is not respectable English magic. In other words, what should be called white magic and what black. There is nothing new here. Were the reader to cast his eye over the offerings of the recent commentators upon magic, he would begin to perceive a curious uniformity of opinion. All recite the same history, and all use the same arguments to establish their conclusions. Perhaps the time has come to ask why this should be so. In every other branch of knowledge, our understanding is enlarged by rational opposition and debate. Law, theology, history, and science have their various factions. Why, then, in magic, do we hear nothing but the same tired arguments? One begins to wonder why anyone troubles to argue at all, since everyone appears to be convinced of the same truths. This dreary monotone is particularly evident in recent accounts of English magical history, which are growing more eccentric with each retelling. 8 years ago, this very author published A Child's History of the Raven King, one of the most perfect things of its kind. It conveys to the reader a vivid sense of the eeriness and wonder of John Usglass's magic. So why does he now pretend to believe that true English magic began in the 16th century with Martin Pale? In Chapter 6 of the Essay on the Extraordinary Revival of English Magic, he declares that Pale consciously set out to purge English magic of its darker elements. He does not attempt to present any evidence for this extraordinary claim, which is just as well, since no evidence exists. According to Portishead's present view, the tradition which began with Pale was more perfectly elaborated by Hickman, Lanchester, Gourbert, Bellasis, et al., those we term the Argentine magicians, and has now reached its glorious apogee with Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange. It is certainly a view that Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell have worked hard to perpetrate, but it simply will not do. Martin Pale and the Argentine magicians never intended to lay the foundations of English magic. In every spell they recorded, in every word they wrote, they were trying to recreate the glorious magic of their predecessors, those we term the Golden Age or Orient magicians, Thomas Godbless, Ralph de Stokesy, Catherine of Winchester, and above all, John Usglass. Martin Pale was the devoted follower of these magicians. He never ceased to regret that he had been born 200 years out of his proper time. One of the most extraordinary characteristics of the revival of English magic has been its treatment of John Usglass. Nowadays, it seems that his name is only spoken in order to revile him. It is as if Mr. Davy and Mr. Faraday and our other great men of science felt obliged to begin their lectures by expressing their contempt and loathing of Isaac Newton, or as if our eminent physicians prefaced every announcement of a new discovery in medicine with a description of the wickedness of William Harvey. Lord Portishead devotes a long chapter of his book to trying to prove that John Usglass is not, as is commonly supposed, the founder of English magic, since there were magicians in these islands before his time. I do not deny it, but what I do most vehemently deny is that there was any tradition of magic in England before John Usglass. Let us examine those earlier magicians that Portishead makes so much of. Who were they? Joseph of Arimathea was one, a magician who came from the Holy Lands and planted a magic tree to protect England from harm. But I never heard that he stayed long enough to teach any of the inhabitants his skills. Merlin was another, but as he was upon his mother's side Welsh and upon his father's infernal, he will scarcely do for that pattern of respectable English magic upon which Portishead, Norrell, and Strange have set their hearts. And who were Merlin's pupils and followers? We cannot name a single one. No, for once, the common view is the correct one. Magic had long been extinct in these islands until John Usglass came out of Faerie and established his kingdom of northern England. Portishead seems to have had some doubts upon this point himself, and in case his arguments have failed to convince his readers, he sets about proving that John Usglass's magic was inherently wicked. But it is far from clear that the examples he chooses support this conclusion. Let us examine one of them. Everyone has heard of the four magical woods that surrounded John Usglass's capital city of Newcastle. Their names were Great Tom, Asmodee's Citadel, Petty Egypt, and Serlo's Blessing. They moved from place to place, and were known upon occasion to swallow up people who approached the city intending harm to the inhabitants. Certainly the notion of man-eating woods strikes us as eerie and horrible. But there is no evidence that John Usglass's contemporaries found it so. It was a violent age. John Usglass was a medieval king, and he acted as a medieval king should, to protect his city and his citizens. Often it is difficult to decide upon the morality of Usglass's actions, because his motives are so obscure. Of all the Orient magicians, he is the most mysterious. No one knows why, in 1138, he caused the moon to disappear from the sky and made it travel through all the lakes and rivers of England. We do not know why, in 1202, he quarreled with winter and banished it from his kingdom, so that for 4 years northern England enjoyed continual summer. Nor do we know why, for 30 consecutive nights in May and June of 1345, every man, woman, and child in the kingdom dreamt that they had been gathered together upon a dark red plain beneath a pale golden sky to build a tall black tower. Each night they labored, waking in the morning in their own beds, completely exhausted. The dream only ceased to trouble them when, on the 30th night, the tower and its fortifications were completed. In all these stories, but particularly in the last, we have a sense of great events going on, but what they might be, we cannot tell. Several scholars have speculated that the tall black tower was situated in that part of hell which Usglass was reputed to lease from Lucifer, and that Usglass was building a fortress in order to prosecute a war against his enemies in hell. However, Martin Pale thought otherwise. He believed that there was a connection between the construction of the tower and the appearance in England 3 years later of the Black Death. John Usglass's kingdom of northern England suffered a good deal less from the disease than its southern neighbor, and Pale believed that this was because Usglass had constructed some sort of defense against it. But, according to the essay on the extraordinary revival of English magic, we have no business even to wonder about such things. According to Mr. Norrell and Lord Portishead, the modern magician ought not to meddle with things only half understood. But I say that it is precisely because these things are only half understood that we must study them. English magic is the strange house we magicians inhabit. It is built upon the foundations that John Usglass made, and we ignore those foundations at our peril. They should be studied and their nature understood so that we can learn what they will support and what they will not. Otherwise, cracks will appear, letting in winds from God knows where. Corridors will lead us to places we never intended to go. In conclusion, Portishead's book, though containing many excellent things, is a fine example of the mad contradiction at the heart of modern English magic. Our foremost magicians continually declare their intention of erasing every hint and trace of John Usglas from English magic. But how is this even possible? It is John Usglas's magic that we do.
Chapter 39 The Two Magicians, February 1815. Of all the controversial pieces ever published in the Edinburgh Review, this was the most controversial by far. By the end of January, there scarcely seemed to be an educated man or woman from one end of the country to the other who had not read it and formed an opinion upon it. And though it was unsigned, everyone knew who the author was. Strange. Oh, certainly at the beginning some people hesitated and pointed to the fact that Strange was as much criticized as Norrell, perhaps more. But these people were judged very stupid by their friends. Was not Jonathan Strange known to be precisely the sort of whimsical, contradictory person who would publish against himself? And did not the author declare himself to be a magician? Who else could it possibly be? Who else could speak with so much authority? When Mr. Norrell had first come to London, his opinions had seemed very new and not a little eccentric. But since then people had grown accustomed to them, and he had seemed no more than the mirror of the times when he said that magic, like the oceans themselves, should agree to be governed by Englishmen. Its boundaries were to be drawn up, and all that was not easily comprehensible to modern ladies and gentlemen, John Usglas's 300-year reign, the strange, uneasy history of our dealings with fairies, might be conveniently done away with. Now Strange had turned the Norrellite view of magic on its head. Suddenly it seemed that all that had been learnt in every English childhood of the wildness of English magic might still be true, and even now on some long-forgotten paths, behind the sky, on the other side of the rain, John Usglas might be riding still with his company of men and fairies. Most people thought the partnership between the two magicians must be broken up. In London there was a rumour that Strange had been to Hanover Square and the servants had turned him away. And there was another contradictory rumour to the effect that Strange had not been to Hanover Square, but that Mr. Norrell was sitting night and day in his library, waiting for his pupil, pestering the servants every 5 minutes to go and look out of the window to see if he were coming. On a Sunday evening in early February, Strange did at last call upon Mr. Norrell. This much was certain, because two gentlemen on their way to St. George's, Hanover Square, saw him standing on the steps of the house, saw the door opened, saw Strange speak to the servant, and saw him instantly admitted as one who had been long expected. The two gentlemen continued on their way to church, where they immediately told their friends in the neighbouring pews what they'd seen. 5 minutes later, a thin, saintly-looking young man arrived at the church. Under the pretext of saying his prayers, he whispered that he had just spoken to someone who was leaning out of the first-floor window of the house next door to Mr. Norrell's, and this person believed that he could hear Mr. Strange ranting and haranguing his master. 2 minutes later, it was being reported throughout the church that both magicians had threatened each other with a kind of magical excommunication. The service began, and several of the congregation were seen to gaze longingly at the windows, as if wondering why those apertures were always placed so high in ecclesiastical buildings. An anthem was sung to the accompaniment of the organ, and some people said later that above the sound of the music they had heard great rolls of thunder, a sure sign of magical disturbances. But other people said that they'd imagined it. All of which would have greatly astonished the two magicians, who were at that moment standing silently in Mr. Norrell's library, regarding each other warily. Strange, who had not seen his tutor for some days, was shocked at his appearance. His face was haggard, and his body shrunken. He looked 10 years older. "Shall we sit down, sir?" said Strange. He moved towards a chair, and Mr. Norrell flinched at the suddenness of the movement. It was almost as if he were expecting Strange to hit him. The next moment, however, he had recovered himself enough to sit down. Strange was not much more comfortable. In the last few days, he had asked himself over and over again if he had been right to publish the review. And repeatedly he had come to the conclusion that he had been. He had decided that the correct attitude to take was one of dignified moral superiority, softened by a very moderate amount of apology. But now that he was actually sitting in Mr. Norrell's library again, he did not find it easy to meet his tutor's eye. His gaze fixed itself upon an odd succession of objects, a small porcelain figure of Dr. Martin Pale, the doorknob, his own thumbnail. Mr. Norrell's left shoe. Mr. Norrell, on the other hand, never once took his eyes from Strange's face.